The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much. My apologies for being late. I just was driven over in a hurry from WHYY, and it ran until noon. Otherwise, I wouldn't keep you waiting like this. I'm going to talk about my new book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Now, this woodcut of the story of the blind man and the elephant reminds us that any complex subject can be approached in multiple ways. And that is certainly true for a subject as complex as human nature. Anthropology can illuminate human nature by studying universals that hold across all human cultures and also the ways in which societies vary. Biology can document how the process of evolution selected the genes that wire the brain. Psychology can get people to disclose their foibles in laboratory experiments. And even fiction can illuminate human nature by showing the universal themes that people find fascinating in the world's myths and stories. This afternoon, I'm going to give you the view from language, what kind of insight we can gain into thought, emotion, and social relations from words and how we use them. I'll discuss grammar as a window into thought, swearing as a window into emotion, and innuendo as a window into social relationships. In each case, I'll start with a puzzle in language, show how it reveals a much deeper feature of the human mind, using specific examples from English, the language with which we're all familiar, but examples that have counterparts in many other languages and that follow a logic that can be found in all languages, even if the particular examples vary. So let me begin with language as a window into thought. And the puzzle comes from a lovely book by Richard Lederer called Crazy English, in which Lederer says, "You have to marvel at the unique lunacy of a language where a house can burn up as it burns down, and in which you fill in a form by filling it out. Why is it called after dark when it is really after light? Things that we claim are underwater and underground are surrounded by, not under, the water and ground." So the first puzzle is, why do languages talk about the physical world in such crazy ways? The answer is that there is a theory of physics embedded in our language, a theory of space in our prepositions, a concept of matter in our nouns, a conception of time in our tenses, and a conception of causality in our verbs. And because we started a bit late, and I know that many of you have to get back to work or school, I'll only talk about one of the four, namely the concept of time that's in our tenses. But more generally, understanding the intuitive physics in language helps explain not just quirks of language of the kind that Lederer calls to our attention, but also the mental models that humans use to make sense of their lives. So how does the language of time work? In many ways, time is conceived like space, where the time is considered to be a linear dimension, and happenings are conceived like matter. Events are conceived as a kind of time stuff that can be located and stretched out along the timeline. We see this in the hundreds of spatial metaphors for time, as when we say, the deadline is coming, or we're approaching the deadline. We see it in the speech errors that children make, like, can I have any reading behind the dinner, meaning after the dinner, as if you have to get through dinner in order to get to the story reading. And we see it in the way verb tense works. The sense of time that's encoded into tense is first of all digitized and second of all relative. That is, no language has tenses for precise intervals or dates. We have specialized words like November 7th, 2007, 3:42 p.m., but you never have tenses in any language that are that specific to a precise interval or to a precise date or day. Instead, location in time, that is where you are along the timeline, is divided into some small number of regions. In English, it's only three, and they're defined relative to the moment of speaking. So there's the present tense, which corresponds to the specious present. That's a term from the psychologist William James, a span of about 3 seconds that we perceive as now. That is, within which we don't order events, but they feel as if they're all happening more or less at the same time. And of course, that 3-second window is constantly moving into the future. But the specious present is the interval of time that corresponds to a deliberate human action, like a handshake, to a quick decision, such as when you're channel surfing, how long you alight on a channel before deciding to move on, to the decay of unrehearsed short-term memory, to a line of poetry, or to a musical motif, like the opening notes to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Then there's the past stretching backwards indefinitely, the second region. So everything from the Big Bang to 4 seconds ago is all treated the same in language, which is why Groucho Marx could say, "I've had a wonderful evening, but this wasn't it." And the third block of time is the future unto eternity, 4 seconds from now until the sun explodes. Now, they're not only locations in time, but they're also shapes in time, what linguists call aspects, namely how an activity is conceived to unfold as it proceeds. And shape in time, like shape in space, is treated schematically. We have actions like to shake, which have no clear beginning and end. They kind of have fuzzy boundaries. It's not clear when something exactly begins to shake or when it stops. We also have events like to swat a fly, which is conceived of as instantaneous or punctate, that occurs at one moment of time. Of course, it literally takes a certain amount of time to raise the fly swatter and bring it down and so on, but we think of it as instantaneous. And then there are events like to cross the street, which have a fuzzy boundary, but which are terminated when some goal is attained, namely, you get to the other side. Now, stretches of time can be mentally packaged. You can start out with some process with fuzzy boundaries, but there are ways in language of chopping it and giving it a determinate shape. So just as in matter, we could take a word like beer, which just refers to the stuff generically with no particular amount or no particular boundary. We can say, "I'll have one beer," meaning a glassful. The word "one" scoops out a portion of beer and makes it into a unit. We can do the same thing in time. So an expression like "to shake it," which has no particular defined beginning and end, can be transformed into "shake it up," namely to shake it until it's completely mixed, and so we impose a boundary on the endpoint of the action. Likewise, you can take "to wring a cloth" with "to wring it out," which also means to completion, until it's there's no water remaining. And that solves the mystery of why a house can burn up as it burns down and why you fill in a form by filling it out. Also, the boundary of an event can be treated like an event itself. Just as you can cut off the end of a ribbon, which you think about it in terms of Euclidean geometry should be impossible because the end has no second dimension, but we conceive of the end as an object, I can say something like, I'm going to begin the end of my talk right now, which if an end were simply a instantaneous termination would be impossible, but we can speak of the end as if it was an event itself. In Crazy English, Letter asks, why is it called after dark when it's really after light? Well, the word "dark" can refer not just to the period of darkness, but to the boundary, the beginning, or the inception of the period of darkness. And it's exactly analogous to why in space we can say underwater when the thing is surrounded by water. Namely, water refers to the surface of the water, and not just to the bulk of the water. So to be underwater means to be under the surface. Why is the language of time so crazy? We distinguish locations in time in the coarse way that we do, these past, present, and future, because stretches of time relative to the moment of speaking have different consequences for knowledge and action. The present tense is our own consciousness, being alive and awake and aware. That flowing experience corresponds to the present tense. The past is what we think of as knowable and factual and unchangeable, as in the Scott Peterson murder case, where, according to the newspapers, investigators noted that Peterson used the past tense when referring to his wife and unborn son before their bodies were found, abruptly correcting himself. The past tense indicated not just when an event occurred, but rather what someone knew about the event. The future, conversely, is not just any old stretch of time, but that portion of time that we consider to be unknowable, hypothetical, willable. As when Winston Churchill said, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender." It's not clear whether this was just a prediction about what kind of events would take place in the future, or a determination of will and resolve. And in fact, those two concepts, the chronological and the will or resolve, are smushed together in the future tense in English and in many other languages. Now, shape and time, I just talked about location and time, is a useful thing to talk about because it allows people to agree on how to package and measure experience. And my favorite example is the question of how many events took place on 9/11 in New York. One could argue that the answer is one because one plan was executed, or you could argue that the answer is two because two buildings were destroyed less than an hour apart. And when you hear a question like this, you might say, oh, well, yeah, that's just semantics. It's kind of like picking nits or debating the number of angels that can dance on the head of a pin. But on the contrary, turns out to be quite a consequential question because the leaseholder for the World Trade Center held an insurance policy that entitled him to $3.5 billion per destructive event. If 9/11 comprised two events, he stood to gain $7 billion. If it comprised just one event, he stood to gain only $3.5 billion. And the case was tied up in court for many years with opposing lawyers arguing over how to construe an event. And so if anyone asks, why should we care about semantics? What is a semantic dispute really worth? Well, it's worth $3.5 billion. That's the answer. So to sum up language as a window into cognition, there's a theory of physics embedded in our language, a conception of space in terms of places and objects in qualitative relationships, a conception of matter in terms of stuff and things stretched out along one, two, or three dimensions, neither of which I explain much in this talk, a conception of time in terms of processes and events that are located and stretched along a single dimension, and a conception of causation in terms of the direct impingement of an actor upon an entity. This way of construing reality differs from what physicists tell us is the best theory of physics, but it corresponds to human goals and purposes, to the causal texture of the environment, to what is knowable, factual, and willable, to ways of packaging and measuring our experience, and to ways of assigning responsibility for events. Let me turn now from thought to emotion, and I will again begin with a puzzle. 4 years ago, the Golden Globe Awards were broadcasted on network television, on NBC, and the rock group U2 was given an award, and accepting the award on behalf of the group, the leader, Bono, said, and I quote, "This is really, really fucking brilliant." Now, the switchboards lit up like a Christmas tree because though you can use the F word on cable television, you cannot use it on broadcast TV. As with the NBC. And so the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, had to decide whether to levy a fine on the network for failing to bleep out the offending word. They decided not to fine the network because their guidelines define indecency as, quote, "material that describes or depicts sexual or excretory organs or activities." And the fucking in fucking brilliant is, quote, "an adjective or an expletive to emphasize an exclamation." Well, a number of congressmen were enraged, and they tried to close the loophole by introducing a number of pieces of legislation into Congress. And I'll read one of them, called the Clean Airwaves Act, House Resolution 3687. "Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled that Section 1464 of Title 18 United States Code is amended, 1. By inserting A before whoever, and 2. The term profane used with respect to language includes the words shit, piss, fuck, cunt, asshole, and the phrases cocksucker, motherfucker, and asshole. Compound use, including hyphenated compounds of such words and phrases, with each other or with other words or phrases, and other grammatical forms of such words and phrases, including verb, adjective, gerund, participle, and infinitive forms." Unfortunately, the fucking and fucking brilliant is an adverb, and that's the one part of speech they forgot to include in the legislation. So, first of all, grammar matters. If anyone ever says, who cares about nouns and verbs and adverbs, that's one reason you should care. But it leads to the question, why do people get so upset about certain words? Indeed, the main legal battleground for debates on free speech through much of the past century has centered on taboo words. Well, this gets us to the language of swearing, in particular the cognitive neuroscience of swearing. What goes on in the brain when you hear or produce a swear word? And the general conclusion is that taboo words activate brain areas associated with negative emotion. They are represented mainly in the right hemisphere, which has independently been connected to negative emotion. When someone produces a taboo word, it seems to originate from the basal ganglia, which is a set of structures buried deep in the brain on either side, evolutionarily quite ancient. And in perception, when you hear a taboo word, you experience activation in the amygdalas, which are two almond-shaped organs also buried deep in the brain, which register threat and other kinds of negative or dangerous stimuli. Also, taboo words are processed involuntarily. Their emotional content is automatically registered by the brain. You can't tune them out. You can't will yourself not to hear a taboo word in terms of the negative emotion it arouses. And so one way to characterize swearing is using language as a weapon, as a little act of aggression, to force a listener to think an unpleasant or at least an emotionally charged thought. This in turn leads to two questions. One of them is, what kinds of concepts trigger negative emotions in human beings? And why would speakers want to trigger negative emotions in their listeners? Doesn't seem like a very nice thing to do. Well, anyone who speaks more than one language knows that the swear words in one language cannot be translated directly into another. Nonetheless, if you look across languages, you find that the different kinds of taboo words fall into more or less five categories. There's the supernatural, as in our very mild curse words, damn, hell, and Jesus Christ, which have become much more acceptable than they used to be. But supernatural taboos still retain their potency in cultures that are more religious. For example, where I grew up in Quebec, which was until recently a very devout Catholic society, in Quebecois French, what you say when you stub your toe or someone cuts you off in traffic is goddamn tabernacle or goddamn chalice. And this religious swearing evokes the emotions of awe and fear. Bodily effluvia and organs are, of course, major sources of taboo words in English. And it's not surprising that we should have emotional reactions to them because epidemiologists tell us that bodily effluvia are major vectors of disease. Many parasitic and infectious diseases are transmitted through feces and mucus and sexual fluids. And so we seem to have evolved an emotion to defend ourselves against infectious disease by these roots, namely the emotion of disgust. Disease, death, and infirmity are sources of taboo language in many societies. In earlier stages of the English language, you could curse someone by saying a pox on you or a plague on both your houses from Romeo and Juliet. And in Yiddish, you can curse by saying cholera, cholera. Even in nowadays, when disease is less of a factor in our lives, there's some taboo associated with the word cancer, and one often reads in an obituary that someone has passed away from, quote, a long illness. And, of course, here we have the emotion of dread of disease and death. Sexuality, I don't have to remind you, is one of the more fertile sources of taboo language in English. And you might say, well, why would you categorize sexuality in terms of negative emotion? Isn't sex between consenting adults supposed to be a source of wholesome fun? Well, not in the full sweep of human experience, because sexuality is also associated with exploitation, illegitimacy, incest, jealousy, spousal abuse, cuckoldry, desertion, child abuse, feuding, and rape. And so people don't treat sexuality with equanimity. It still gets an emotional rise out of people, even in these sexually liberated times. And we can call that the emotion of revulsion at sexual depravity. Finally, there are taboo words for disfavored peoples and groups in many languages, words for infidels, cripples, enemies, and subordinate peoples, including the most inflammatory word in English, the word that is so incendiary that we need a word to refer to the word, namely the N-word or nigger, one of many racial epithets that have taboo status. And here the emotion is hatred and contempt of subordinate peoples. Well, if those are the kinds of emotion that are evoked by taboo words, why do people try to evoke negative emotion in their listeners? Well, it turns out there are lots of reasons for people to engage in this kind of verbal aggression. There are at least five ways to swear. The first is what can be called dysphemistic swearing. This is the difference, say, between shit and feces or fuck and copulate. That is, words that are synonyms, but have very different emotional impacts. Now, you all are familiar with the term euphemism. The logic behind a euphemism is we have to talk about this for a specific purpose, but let's avoid thinking about how awful it is. A dysphemism works the other way around. It's the kind of word you use when you want someone to think about how awful something is. Now, we do need euphemisms. We are incarnate beings. Feces is a part of human life, and every now and again there are occasions to bring it up with other people. But because you want to make it clear that if you're bringing it up out of necessity and not to offend your listener, the English language provides at least 34 words that allow you to talk about it without pinging that emotional button in the brain of your listeners. There are generic terms like waste and fecal matter. Formal terms, often from Latin, like feces and excrement. Terms you use with children, like poop and doo-doo. Terms that you use of children, like soil and dirt. Terms in a medical context, like stool and bowel movement. Then for animals, there's a large variety of terms, some for large units, like pats, some for small units, like droppings. Terms used in a scientific context, like scat. Ones used in an agricultural context, like manure and guano. And in this age of recycling, we need words to refer to human waste that's recycled as fertilizer. And I've seen at least three: night soil, humanure, and human biosolids. Now, this is all very handy, but and in fact, there are, each one of these euphemisms is specific to a context in which you have no choice but to discuss feces, but you don't want to gross out your listener. And if you use the wrong euphemism in the wrong context, the results can be rather odd. So I think you would blink if at your next medical examination the nurse said the medical lab will need a doo-doo sample. Or if you were to read in a gardening book, for nice plump tomatoes, fertilize your plants with cattle bowel movement. But we also need dysphemisms. There are times in life when the point of politeness has been passed, and you want to remind your listener of how awful the activity that they or object that they are engaged in is. For example, you might open your window and yell at someone, "Will you pick up your dog shit?" No euphemism will do in those circumstances, because the point of yelling at that person is because they have done something offensive, and you want to tell that person how offensive it is. Or the plumber was working under the sink and I had to look at the crack in his ass the whole time. Or you can imagine a woman saying upon snooping in her husband's email, "So while I've been taking care of the kids, you've been fucking your secretary," where the offensiveness is intentional, and the English language gives us the means of expressing the offense. Well, a second way of swearing is abusive swearing. Every once in a while, people feel the urge to intimidate or humiliate someone that they don't like. And scholars who have studied maledicta, That is the language of cursing and abuse across history, have often been impressed at the sheer ingenuity that has gone into abusive swearing, the amount of mental resources that people put into crafting the perfect curse or imprecation. And all of the poetic devices, metaphor, imagery, connotation, alliteration, meter, and rhyme, are put to use in abusive swearing. You can liken people to bodily effluvia and their associated organs and accessories, as when you call someone a piece of shit or an asshole or a dickhead. You can advise them to engage in undignified activities, such as eat shit, shove it up your ass, fuck yourself. You can accuse them of having engaged in undignified sexual activities. And for every undignified sexual activity, there is a standard English curse. For incest, for example, sodomy, fellatio, masturbation. And my favorite, this is a curse that hasn't been in use since the 1500s, but I advise you to try it out the next time someone takes a parking space that you've been waiting for, because all of these curses, I think, are kind of cliched and hackneyed. But if instead you were to revive the 1585 curse and you said, kiss the cunt of a cow, not only would there at least be some fresh imagery, but I think it has a rather pleasing alliteration. Now, there's idiomatic swearing, and this is probably the mildest form of swearing, when people use clichés like shit out of luck, get your shit together, piss poor, pissed off, my ass, a pain in the ass, sweet fuck all, what the fuck, where it's not exactly clear what those words are doing there. And in fact, they're not. Their referent has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual content of the message, but the speaker is simply using the emotional reaction to keep waking up or jabbing the listener. They can arouse a listener's attention. They can assert a macho or cool pose. And sometimes they can just express informality among a circle of friends as if to say, this is the kind of setting in which you don't have to watch what you say. And similar to that is emphatic swearing, in which, such as Bono's This Is Really, Really Fucking Brilliant, or He Thinks He's a Fucking Scoutmaster, or Rip Van Fucking Winkle, where... where, again, it's not clear what the meaning of the word has to do with its current use, other than as a kind of cheap way of waking up your listener. And the overuse of idiomatic and emphatic swearing has led to the form of speech sometimes called fuck patois, such as the story of the soldier who said, I come home to my fucking house after 3 fucking years in the fucking war, and what do I fucking well find? My wife in bed engaging in illicit sexual relations with a man. Then there's cathartic swearing, the phenomenon where if you, when some misfortune befalls you, if you cut your thumb together with a bagel or you spill a glass of wine into your lap, the topic of your conversation abruptly turns to excretion, sexuality, or religion. Now, if you ask people, why do you swear this way, they'll say something like, it lets off steam or it relieves tension. But this is the hydraulic theory of the brain. But unfortunately, neurobiologists have not found any vessel with pressurized steam in the brain and a bunch of pipes and valves, only brain cells that fire in patterns. And so a more satisfying theory is the rage circuit theory, which is that throughout the mammals, there is a reflex in which an animal that is suddenly injured or confined will emit a sudden angry noise to startle or intimidate an attacker. And anyone who has stepped on the tail of a pet cat is familiar with this reflex. The idea is that humans have inherited a version of this reflex, but in our case, because our language system also has control over the vocal tract, we don't just yelp and yowl, but we articulate our outburst by uttering words for negative emotion and words that we ordinarily inhibit ourselves from saying. Now, I think there's a lot to this theory, but there is a limitation, which is cathartic swearing is conventional. As I mentioned, you have to learn the particular swear words in a particular language. It's just not satisfying for me in English to say tabernacle or whore, which is a swear word in Portuguese and Spanish. And also, even in English, you have to, believe it or not, you choose the word that you use to swear even when you're in sudden pain or frustration. If the cause of your current misfortune is an inanimate event, like you hit your thumb with a hammer or you bump your head while getting into a car, you don't shout out asshole, but that's what you might say if someone suddenly jostles you or takes your parking spot. So this leads to a theory from the brilliant sociologist Irving Goffman, who indeed spent his career here at the University of Pennsylvania, the response cry theory, which is that cathartic swearing is communicative. It conveys to bystanders that you're in the throes of some strong negative emotional state, and that it's not just an outflowing of nervous energy, but it actually conveys a message. And in that regard, it's like other response cries in the language, like aha, ouch, whoops, yow, wow, yes, and yuck. So to sum up, language is a window into emotion. Humans are prone to strong negative emotions, awe of the supernatural, disgust at bodily effluvia, dread of disease, hatred of disfavored people and groups, revulsion at depraved sexual acts. Nonetheless, people sometimes want to impose these thoughts on others to gain their attention, to intimidate or humiliate them, to remind them of the awfulness of the objects and activities, or to advertise that one has the normal reactions to misfortunes. Well, let me turn to the final part of the talk. Language is a window into social relations. And again, I'll begin with a puzzle. This one is taken from the movie Fargo, in which a kidnapper has a hostage in the back seat of the car, is pulled over by a police officer because he's missing his plates, and is asked to hand over his driver's license. Well, he hands over his wallet with the license exposed and a $50 bill sticking out ever so slightly, and he says, "I was thinking that maybe the best thing would be to take care of it here in Brainerd." Now, of course, the officer and the audience interprets this not at face value, but as a veiled bribe. This is an example of an indirect speech act, a case in which people don't just blurt out exactly what they mean, but rather veil their intentions in innuendo and doublespeak. And here are some other examples. If you could pass the guacamole, that would be awesome. Now, if you think about it, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But nonetheless, we interpret it as a polite request. "We're counting on you to show leadership in our campaign for the future, i.e. give money." Anyone who sat through a fundraising dinner is familiar with euphemistic snoring such as that. "Would you like to come up and see my etchings?" For at least 80 years, that's been understood as a sexual come-on. And "Nice store you got there. Would be a real shame if something happened to it." We all recognize as a veiled threat. So the puzzle is, why are bribes, requests, seductions, solicitations, and threats so often veiled when both parties know exactly what they mean? And this is not just a question of intellectual curiosity, but it also has practical importance in the crafting and interpretation of the language of diplomacy and in the prosecution of extortion, bribery, and sexual harassment. Well, I have found this a maddeningly difficult problem, and I think the solution comes in at least three parts: the logic of plausible deniability, the logic of relationship negotiation, and the logic of mutual knowledge. And I'll now explain what I mean by each of those. Let's begin with what game theorists call the identification problem, led by Thomas Schelling, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. Namely, how do you deal with another intelligent agent when you don't know his or her values? And bribing a police officer is a good example. You have two options. Assuming that you always mean what you say, you can either offer a bribe or not. The problem is you don't know who you're dealing with. You don't know whether you're dealing with a dishonest officer who would accept the bribe or an honest officer who would not only rebuff the bribe but might arrest you for attempting to bribe an officer. And the payoffs are very different depending on what kind of officer you get. If you don't offer the bribe at all, you get a traffic ticket in either case. If you do offer the bribe, and you're lucky enough to get a dishonest officer, you get the very high payoff of going free. But if you're unlucky enough to get an honest officer, you're risking an arrest for bribery. So the payoffs are very asymmetrical, and the choice between these two is not clear. On the other hand, if you had a third option, namely a veiled bribe, like I was wondering if maybe we could take care of it here in Brainerd, then a dishonest officer could sniff out the bribe and accept it, and you'd have the high payoff of going free. An honest officer couldn't make the charge of bribery stick in court because of the vague nature of the language, and so the worst he could give you is a traffic ticket. So you get the very high payoff of an overt bribe with a relatively small cost of not bribing at all combined into one option, and so the choice is obvious. So this is the logic of plausible deniability. But it can't be the whole story, because what about non-legal contexts? It's not as if we only use indirect speech when we're bribing a police officer and we're facing jail or a fine and so on. What about everyday life in which you might want to offer a bribe? Now, you might think, when would I ever want to offer a bribe in everyday life? Well, how's this? You want to go to the hottest restaurant in town. You have no reservation. How about slipping the maitre d' a $50 bill in exchange for a quick table? Well, this was the assignment given to the food writer Bruce Feiler for Gourmet magazine, and I found it very instructive to see his account of accepting that assignment. He starts off the article by confessing to extreme anxiety. "I am nervous," he wrote, "truly nervous. As the taxi bounces through the trendier neighborhoods of Manhattan, I keep imagining the possible retorts of some incensed maitre d'. What kind of an establishment do you think this is? How dare you insult me? Do you think you can get in with that?" The second interesting outcome is that when he did screw up the courage to offer the bribe, he did it indirectly. He thought up indirect speech acts on the spot, like, "I hope you can fit us in," or, "Can you speed up my weight?" Or, "I was wondering if you might have a cancellation," or, "This is a really important night for me." And the third interesting report was the outcome. What do you think happened? Well, the answer was that he was invariably seated in between 2 and 4 minutes, as he put it, "to the astonishment of my girlfriend." So what's going on here? Well, here's a theory that language has to do two things at once. It has to convey the content, the bribe, the command, the proposition, but at the same time negotiate a relationship that you have with the other person. And the solution is to use language at two levels. The speaker uses the literal form of his words to signal the safest relationship to a listener, while counting on the listener to read between the lines to entertain a proposition that might be incompatible with that relationship. And a simple case is politeness. Now, when you hear a sentence like, "If you could pass the guacamole, that would be awesome," I mean, first of all, you can't take it at face value. It makes no sense. It's an overstatement. I mean, it wouldn't really be awesome just to get the guacamole. And also, it's kind of irrelevant. Why is this person pondering hypothetical possible worlds at the dinner table? But, of course, the listener thinks the speaker says an outcome is good, therefore he must be requesting it. The overall effect is that the intended content, namely an imperative, is successfully communicated, but without the presumption of dominance, the assumption that the person you're talking to is some kind of underling or flunky who can be expected to comply with your commands. So what kind of relationships do people negotiate? Well, one of them is dominance, but it's only one kind. And the anthropologist Alan Fiske has suggested, based on his anthropological research, that all human relationships fall into three categories. Each one prescribes a distinct way of distributing resources, and each has a distinct evolutionary basis, which makes it apply most naturally to certain people, but you can extend it through negotiation to others. So there's dominance, as I've mentioned, which follows the logic, "don't mess with me." We see it in the dominance hierarchies in many other animals throughout the primate order. There's communality, which instead uses the rule, "share and share alike." This has its evolutionary basis in kin selection and mutualism, and is most naturally extended to family members, to spouses, and to close friends. Then there's reciprocity. which follows the rule, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. The exchange of goods and services in a business-like relationship, which is can be explained evolutionarily as a form of reciprocal altruism. Now, critically, behavior that's acceptable in one relationship type is anomalous in another. So while at a cocktail party, you might go over to your girlfriend's plate and help yourself to a shrimp off her plate, you wouldn't go over to your boss or your teacher and help yourself to a shrimp off their plate, because what is acceptable with a girlfriend, the communality relationship, is not acceptable to a superior where the dominance relationship is going on. Likewise, if at the end of a dinner party you pulled out your wallet and offered to pay the host for the cost of the food, that would be seen not as polite, but rather as rude. And that's because you're suggesting a relationship of reciprocity when the whole idea of friends getting together is communality. Now, if two people have divergent understandings of which relationship type applies to them, then the result can be an unpleasant emotion that we call awkwardness. For example, there can be awkward moments in a workplace when an employee doesn't know whether he can call his boss by his first name or invite him out after work for a beer. Everyone knows that good friends should not engage in a major business transaction, like one selling the other one a car, that it can put a strain on the friendship. And that's because of the clash between reciprocity and communality. The conflict between dominance and sex, such as a boss propositioning an employee, sets the stage for sexual harassment. And the conflict between friendship and sex is what makes dating so tense and interesting. This gives rise to a social identification where the social costs of awkwardness from a mismatched relationship type can duplicate the payoff matrix of the legal identification problem, such as in bribing a cop. So take bribing a maitre d', where the challenge is you're offering a quid pro quo reciprocity relationship where ordinarily a maitre d' exerts dominance over his restaurant fiefdom. Now, if you don't offer a bribe, you can either fail to offer a bribe or offer one, but you don't know whether you're facing a corrupt maitre d' who will seat you immediately or a scrupulous maitre d' who would say, "How dare you insult me? What kind of an establishment do you think this is?" And the payoffs are very different in each case. Of course, if you don't offer a bribe, then you're accepting the dominance relationship and you also accept the long wait regardless of the kind of maitre d' you have. If you offer a naked bribe, then if you have a corrupt maitre d' who accepts the reciprocity relationship, you get the benefit of a quick table. If you get a scrupulous maitre d', though, who insists on maintaining dominance while you're trying for reciprocity, then you get the socially awkward situation that made the writer so nervous. But if you can frame an ambiguous bribe, like I was wondering if you had a cancellation, you get a corrupt maitre d' can recognize it and offer you a quick table, consummating the reciprocity relationship. A scrupulous maitre d' can choose to ignore it, and the worst that you suffer is the long wait. You get the small cost of not offering a bribe with the high benefit of offering one packed into a single option, so it's the rational choice. Well, there's one remaining problem, which is that people aren't naive. Usually both parties know when an overture has been made by innuendo. I mean, who could really claim to be fooled by, "I was hoping you might have a cancellation," as the guy's holding up a $50 bill, or coming up and seeing my etchings? Life isn't a court of law. It's not like you have to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. So the deniability is not really plausible. Why should an obvious indirect overture feel less awkward than an overture that's blurted out and seems to be on the record? And I'll illustrate the puzzle with a scene from the romantic comedy When Harry Met Sally, where early in the movie, Harry and Sally have just met each other, and Harry makes a sexual remark. Sally says, "You're coming on to me." Harry says, "What do you want me to do about it?" "I take it back, okay? I take it back." She says, "You can't take it back." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Because it's already out there." And he said, "Oh, geez, what are we supposed to do? Call the cops? It's already out there." But it raised the question, what is the status of an overture that is out there, that is on the record, that once said can't be unsaid, that makes it worse than a veiled overture that's implicated indirectly? Well, I think a key to it is a concept from logic called mutual knowledge, which is must be distinguished from shared knowledge. In shared knowledge, A knows X and B knows X. In mutual knowledge, A knows X, B knows X, A knows that B knows X, B knows that A knows X, A knows that B knows that A knows X ad infinitum. And this is a distinction that makes a real difference. For example, why is freedom of assembly enshrined as a fundamental right in a democracy, and why are so many political revolutions instigated when people turn out en masse in front of a palace? Well, prior to the rally, everyone knew that they were disgruntled. But during the rally, everyone now knows that everyone else is disgruntled, and they know that everyone else can see that they are disgruntled and that everyone can see it of everyone else. That collective understanding empowers them to challenge a leader who otherwise would be able to pick them off one at a time. Likewise, you all know the story of the emperor's new clothes. Well, when the little boy said the emperor is naked, he wasn't telling anyone there anything that they didn't already know, that they couldn't see with their very own eyes. But he was conveying information nonetheless. Now everyone knew that everyone else knew, and they knew that everyone else knew that they knew, and once again that allowed them to challenge the emperor to change their relationship. And the crucial aspect of that is that language is a very good way of creating mutual knowledge. When you blurt something out, you know that they know that you know, etc. So here's a hypothesis. Innuendos merely provide shared knowledge, whereas direct speech provides mutual knowledge, and relationships are maintained or nullified by a mutual knowledge of the relationship type. So if Harry says, "Would you like to come up and see my etchings?" then Sally may know that she's turned down an overture, and Harry knows that she's turned down an overture. But does Sally know that Harry knows? Sally might be thinking, maybe Harry thinks I'm naive. And does Harry know that Sally knows that he knows? Harry might be thinking, maybe Sally thinks I'm dense. There's no mutual knowledge, and so they can maintain the fiction of a friendship. Whereas if Harry had said, "Would you like to come up and have sex?" then if Sally turns him down, Harry knows that Sally knows that Harry knows that Sally knows, and they cannot maintain the fiction of a friendship. And I think that's what's behind the sense that you can't take it back. It's already out there. So to sum up, language is a window into social relationships. People have to convey messages while unsure of their relationship. Indirect speech can minimize the risks in legal contexts with tangible costs like bribes and threats. The same thing can happen in everyday life because relationship mismatches have an emotional cost. And also, indirect speech prevents shared knowledge from becoming mutual knowledge, and mutual knowledge is the basis for a relationship. So let me give an overall summary. Often, psychologists have to try to make the familiar seem strange, to get people to step back from themselves and to think about aspects of their own mind that they ordinarily take for granted because they're so familiar. And one way to do that is to talk about a hypothetical Martian scientist who comes to this planet and has to characterize our species as if we were just another organism. How would a Martian biologist describe our species? Well, this afternoon, I've asked the question, how would a Martian linguist describe our species, knowing only about how we use words? Well, I think he might observe the following about Homo sapiens. Humans have an intuitive theory of the physical world. They locate things in space by identifying places and locating objects in discrete relationships to them. They construe matter as formless stuff or discrete things which are stretched along one, two, or three dimensions. They order and package events in time relative to their own moment of consciousness. And they explain events by identifying their causes, namely an actor that impinges upon an entity. Human intuitive physics differs from real physics, but it helps them to reason and agree about aspects of reality that are relative to their purposes, their understanding of cause and effect, what they can know, change, and will, how they identify and quantify their experience, and how they assign moral and legal responsibility. Humans not only entertain thoughts, but they steep them with emotion. They stand in awe of deities. They are terrified by disease, death, and infirmity. They are revolted by bodily secretions. They loathe enemies, traitors, and subordinate peoples. And they take a prurient interest in sexuality and all its variations. Despite having negative reactions to so many thoughts, humans willingly inflict these thoughts on one another to remind them of the unpleasant nature of certain things, to intimidate or denigrate them, to get their attention, or to advertise their reactions to life's frustrations and setbacks. When it comes to social life, humans are very, very touchy about their relationships. With some of their fellows, typically kin, lovers, and friends, humans freely share and do favors. With others, they jockey for dominance. With still others, they trade goods and services. People distinguish these relationships sharply. When one person breaches the logic of a relationship with another, they both suffer an emotional cost. Nonetheless, humans often risk these breaches, sometimes to get on with the business of life, sometimes to renegotiate their relationship. Humans think a lot about what other humans think about them, and their relationships are ratified by this mutual knowledge. They know that others know that they know what kind of relationship they share. As a result, to preserve their relationships while transacting the business of their lives, humans often engage in hypocrisy and taboo. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. And if there are questions, we ask you to find someone with a microphone or wait for the microphone bearer to find you so that everyone else can hear the question. Yeah.
I think enjoyed your talk very much.
Thank you.
One question which may be a little tangential to this presentation. Could you comment on why most scientists or technical people tend not to be poetic and vice versa? Why more poetic people tend not to be analytical or scientific? I mean, is there a biological basis for that? Or
I mean, it's certainly not a generalization that holds in every case. And we also know that on average, intelligence in both verbal forms and analytical and mathematical forms are correlated, though of course not perfectly correlated. The correlation is the basis for the whole concept of general intelligence, or G. So even if the poet who says, I'm terrible at math, is the brilliant poet is probably better at math than the average for the population, though not, of course, as good in math as they are in verbal creativity. We know that the general intelligence dimension is highly heritable. When it comes to the difference between the mathematical and the more mathematical and the more verbal flavors of intelligence, it's less clear, but it's highly likely the genes have something to do with it. But it is not the case, though, that there is some kind of trade-off, like some sort of finite brain tissue, and the more you devote to analytical abilities, the less you have left over for verbal or poetic or vice versa. I suspect that whatever initial difference might be created by genetic differences then can snowball as you invest in your own kind of personal capital, that is, you enhance the skills you have, you spend more and more hours of the day making yourself better at what you're already good at, and so whatever small differences might have been there at present then start to diverge throughout life as you come to specialize and hone your skills.
A question about solitary swearing.
Yeah.
For myself, I find I'm very conscious, very aware when I do it, that I am violating a taboo in order to exercise control over the inanimate.
Over
That's
the
why I do it.
Over the enemy?
No, over the inanimate.
Oh, the inanimate.
Life is out of control, but at least I can swear.
Like the knife that cuts your thumb. You're controlling kind of that kind of misfortune?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But the computer goes bad.
Yeah, or the computer. Yes, that's right. Who among us hasn't cursed the computer when it doesn't do what we want? Solitary swearing is interesting. People do swear more when there's an audience, but you're right that they also swear alone. Irving Goffman, if I could channel his ghost from the sociology department here at Penn, would say that you never are not performing for an audience, even when you're alone. That we are so constituted that there's a virtual audience at all times. That the notion, he would argue, that there is such a thing as a true self that is revealed when we're solitary is a kind of myth, and that the self that we seem to control when we're alone really is a social self that we would be presenting if there were people present. We can never get away from this virtual audience. That would be his interpretation. It's also possible that because the point of cathartic swearing is, even if Goffman is right, to make it clear to any bystanders that you're now in the throes of some overpowering emotion that has taken command of your nervous system, that's how bad it is, then for it to be effective, for it really to reflect this involuntary outflowing, you should not be able to turn it off. It should be automatic. That makes it all the more compelling when there are bystanders around. If you could turn it on and off and will, it would no longer be an honest signal of your involuntary state. Yes.
When it comes to something like linguistic determinism, which, if I'm not totally mistaken, you're kind of opposed to, as am I agree with you. Excuse me. Do you think that people genuinely believed in strict, like, linguistic determinism, or do you think it's a matter of mere semantics?
Well, I think linguistic determinism is the hypothesis that the language you speak determines the thoughts that you can think. And it's one of a number of hypotheses that are often called Whorfian, based on the linguist Benjamin Lee Whorf. In the Stuff of Thought, I distinguish like 10 or 11 different versions of the hypothesis, of which linguistic determinism, as compared to linguistic relativity, would be the strongest. I think many people do believe in linguistic determinism. I often hear people say, well, I, especially bilinguals, well, sometimes I think in English, sometimes it's different than when I think in Spanish. People are often surprised by the idea that there can be thoughts that you can't express in language. And in the humanities, there are many statements, overt statements, in which philosophers and literary critics say reality is socially constructed through language, that you can't escape from the prison house of language, that reality is just a web of words. So even the most extreme forms do have their adherents. Most psychologists, if they believe in it at all, believe in a much more diluted form. I think there are some very diluted forms that have some merit. I think that having a word for a concept gives you a mental representation that allows you to chunk it in working memory, and therefore not to have to analyze all of its content, but to use it as a unit that can offload some of the resource demands on thinking. But I think most stronger forms are unlikely. I think a lot of them come from a failure to distinguish correlation from causation, of which perhaps the simplest example is the claim that the Eskimos distinguish 14 varieties of snow because their language has 14 words for snow, as opposed to the other way around.
In your discussion of the foul words, the curse words, or whatever, you say nothing about vocabulary. Do people use words because they lack a vocabulary to adequately avoid using those words?
I think the use of idiomatic swearing might often reflect a certain kind of linguistic laziness, in that if you have a... if you have to resort to fucking every other word because you're afraid your listener will get bored, that is a confession that you haven't put enough work into making your words worth attending to for any other reason. And I think that's why many people who love language get kind of fed up with the fuck patois, because it does betray a kind of if not restricted vocabulary, at least a laziness in using it. And I find it annoying when in magazines more and more often, especially magazines aiming at that are kind of trying to be, you know, hip and edgy, use words, I think judiciously. There are circumstances in which there's no substitute for a taboo word, but just to use it because you don't feel like going to the thesaurus, so you can't think of any other reason to make your language worth attending to, I think is a confession of a bad writer. Yeah. There's someone at the back who's had her hand up for quite some time, so let's go all the way to the back.
Thank you. I guess I was wondering if you could say something about gender differences in the approach to language and swear words.
Yeah, I don't. I write very little about gender differences in this book. I discuss them in my previous book, The Blank Slate. But I do allude to someone who has explored those differences much more in depth, namely Deborah Tannen in her book You Just Don't Understand, a bestseller about 13 years ago. And what I note is that when Tannen expanding on the idea that men and women speak different languages, well, of course, they don't literally speak different languages. They don't use different nouns and verbs and grammatical constructions. But they do sometimes, on average, differ in the indirect speech that I concentrated on in the third part of the talk, the innuendo, the reading between the lines. And Tannen discusses many cases in which couples nearly come to blows because the each one has a different implicature or reading between the lines of an indirect speech act. I mean, an example is, say, a wife or a girlfriend comes home from work and is very upset about some way in which she's been mistreated, or some, you know, idiot in the workplace, or someone who something that's gone terribly wrong. And the husband says, okay, well, here's how you can deal with it. Let's break the problem down, and then you can write an email with a number of bullet points. You say first this, first that, and then this is how you know, deal with it in the future. And then she blows up and says, no, you know, as Tannen entitled a book, You Just Don't Understand, that is, in recounting the episode, the idea was not to solicit his help in problem solving, but rather to solicit his sympathy. And neither of them, of course, was directly solicited in so many words, but the male, according to Tannen, has made the wrong guess as to what the underlying intent was, namely an attempt to rationally solve the problem versus an attempt at emotional closeness. So that would be, to the extent that Tannen is correct, that these, at least on average, characterize men and women to different extents, at least in interaction with one another, that is the component of language that is most likely to differ between men and women. Also, I should mention one other, given that the middle third of the talk was on swearing. Swearing is by and large a guy thing. We even have the old expression, language that you can use in mixed company meaning men and women. And terms like locker room language, namely swearing is something that men do in the company of other men. Now, of course, that seems a little quaint nowadays, but where the use of taboo language has expanded to women, it happened in my generation in the late 60s and 70s, much to the shock of our parents. I had a friend whose father used to say to her, Nancy, your mouth is like a toilet. Nonetheless, statistically, it is still true that on average, men swear more often than women.
I'm a senior in high school, and over the summer, one of the books we have for required reading was 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, the totalitarian government condensed the entire English language into about a 500-word vocabulary, and all of the polysyllabic words were truncated to about one or two syllables. One, would that be possible in today's world if a government had that kind of power, and what would be the effects on language and communication?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, I dealt with that in not in this book. Not in this book, but in my previous book, The Language Instinct, I began one of the chapters with that very example. Because Orwell, in 1984, and in that appendix that you're alluding to, the Newspeak Language, he goes back and forth as to whether he thinks that, in one place he says, well, because the concept of freedom, for example, no longer existed, you don't need a word for it. And you could, in Newspeak, you can only use the word free to say something like the house is, the lawn is free of weeds or the house is free of rats. You can't, no longer use it to refer to political freedom. But then a couple of sentences later, he says, well, since the government has changed the language, people can no longer think the thought because they have no way to think it, having been deprived of the word. Note, by the way, that that connects to the previous question about linguistic determinism, namely the idea that you can't think a thought unless your language provides a word for it. So Orwell, in that appendix, was, at least in one part, subscribing to a strong theory of linguistic determinism, that the citizens of, I guess it was Oceania, would no longer even be able to entertain the concept of freedom and other democratic concepts because they've been wiped out of the language. I personally don't think that that's what would happen, simply because a language can never be legislated from the top down. It always bubbles up from people speaking with one another, and if the word freedom didn't, even if they did manage to drive it out of the language at a given time, people would come up with another synonym by using a metaphor, by using a figure of speech, by borrowing it from some other language. So I think as soon as, especially as children started to acquire the language, they would very quickly convert it back into a regular human language, and it couldn't survive in that form for very long. But it's a terrific example of how the linguistic determinism hypothesis has been played out in fiction. Two more questions. Let's try to get the other side of the room. Yes. Who's been waving their hand the longest? Yes.
Sorry. I had a negative reaction to your use of the word subordinate people, but then later you used the word disfavored. Totally different reaction.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, did you envision writing this book when you wrote the blank slate?
No, I only had the idea for this book after the Language Instinct and the Blank Slate were completed. Yes, and by subordinated peoples, I mean peoples who, in the eyes of the people who originate the negative, the pejorative term, consider them subordinate. And in the case, of course, African Americans in the United States, there was legal subordination under slavery and then the Jim Crow laws. So in both senses, African Americans played the role of a subordinated people. And so it's not a coincidence that that the pejorative term for them arose, as it did for peoples who were disenfranchised or impoverished because they were immigrants. And for just about every immigrant group, there is a negative term corresponding to the N-word. Although nowadays, because, say, prejudice against Italians is much less severe than racism against African Americans, the pejorative terms for Italian, like Dago and Wop and Guinea and so on, if you watch The Godfather, you'll hear them all. Those are not as incendiary as the N-word, because racism against African Americans today is stronger than prejudice against Italians. Probably 100 years ago, when the prejudices were may have been more comparable, both of those words were incendiary.
Why would you shift?
But what I shift what?
Using those two words.
Which two?
The first you said disfavored. The first you
subordinate,
then disfavored.
Oh, disfavored. Yes. Oh, well, in the... The taboo words can be used in both cases, so I was sort of lumping them together in the category of just people for whom taboo words tend to arise spontaneously. So sometimes they're people who are disfavored, and you can have a taboo word. Sometimes they're people who are legally subordinated. But any group of people around which some other group of people have negative opinions, that second group of people can often develop taboo words, words that you use very carefully or that you know will offend if you use them.
You talked at some length about how swear words produce a sort of visceral negative response when they're heard. Are there any other words or terms that produce involuntary responses but of a less negative connotation?
A lot of words, probably all words, have some degree of emotional coloring, where taboo words are tend to be at the extreme end. But even in choosing words like slender versus slim versus skinny versus scrawny, it could be the same person that you're using those four words to refer to, yet they all differ in the degree of emotionality and the direction of the emotionality. Or if someone is voluptuous versus fat, for example, again, it could be the same person, but one gets voluptuous is kind of sexy, and fat in general is not. Part of choosing a word, if you're a wordsmith, is to choose the word from a set of synonyms that will evoke the emotion that you want in your listeners or readers, be it positive or negative, or in the case of swear words, extremely negative. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Folks, thank you very much for coming. Please join us upstairs for the book signing afterward.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.